Hey everybody, this is Charlie McCoy from Nashville. You're listening to Dave Lefkowitz on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this very special Saturday morning. I've got to be careful not to make this intro even longer than the interview, just because there's so much to say about the musician that we're going to be talking to. His name is Charlie McCoy. And if his name perhaps doesn't ring the bell that some of the legendary pop stars do, well, you've heard him on their records, not to mention his own records. Let me just give you the stats on this guy. He did 14 albums for the legendary Monument Records and a bunch of albums after that. He has done more than 12,000 studio sessions for other artists. At one point, he was doing 400 sessions a year for like a decade and a half. He's in the Country Music Hall of Fame. He's been in the music business now more than five decades. He won a Grammy for his 1972 album, The Real McCoy. And Charlie McCoy has worked with, all right, I'm going to take a deep breath to get some of these names out. Just people like Bob Dylan, Conway Twitty, Johnny Cash, Dolly Parton, Loretta Lynn, George Jones, Ray Stevens, Chet Atkins, Gordon Lightfoot, Ringo Starr, Simon and Garfunkel, Perry Como, Elvis Presley. I don't know if this is the greatest thing or not, that John Lennon, in his early harmonica playing with the Beatles, was influenced by the style of the man that we are going to talk to right now. He is Charlie McCoy. He is coming to Greeley tomorrow afternoon on a bill with Richard Kaiser and Floyd Kramer over at the UCCC. There's my intro. Welcome to Greeley, Charlie McCoy.
Thank you, Dave. It's nice to be with you this morning.
Well, nice to have you here. And you told me before we started this that you have never been to Greeley, Colorado.
Never have. You know, I've been to Denver a few times, but never to Greeley. Looking forward to it.
Well, yeah, and I also mentioned that you came at a particularly odd time for what's going on in northern Colorado. Have you, in all your experiences, been to natural disasters and floods and fires and things like that?
Well, we had the biggest flood in 500 years in 2010 here in Nashville.
Oh, my gosh. When, and what was that like for you personally?
Well, I mean, we were safe. We live up on a hillside, but this city was a lot of trouble here. I guess the best way to explain it, number one, we had water in the first row of the seats in the Tennessee Titans football stadium. But the real one that really showed how bad things were, the night after the rain stopped, they did a report on the local news from the Grand Ole Opry House in a boat.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was tough.
Unfortunately, that's what folks are going through, not necessarily where you'll be, not in that west part side of town, but other parts of Greeley and Evans and Fort Collins and Boulder, of course. They're really going through some stuff.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
As what's kind of nice is that you mentioned that you'll come here for a couple of hours, play some music, and take people's minds off what's been going on.
Well, we hope so. That's for sure. Richard Kaiser is a great musician, and also Jason Coleman, the grandson of Floyd Kramer. And when you close your eyes, you think you're hearing Floyd. I mean, everyone plays the notes, but he's got the touch.
And of course, you have the touch too on 12 zillion different instruments. But specifically about the concert that's happening on Sunday, is it secular? Because Kaiser is gospel, Christian gospel driven.
Yeah, we do some gospel, but for the most part, it's secular.
So what are some of the kinds of songs that you'll be doing?
Well, we do things like On the Road Again, San Antonio Rose, Yakety Axe, Orange Blossom Special. Yeah, it's a real mixture of a mixed bag of songs. Jason does some great things like Make the World Go Away and Freight Train and Oh Lonesome Me. And yeah, so it's basically country, a little gospel thrown in.
And you guys have done this packaging together before, so you've all played together this show, as it were.
Well, we kind of started doing this about 4 years ago down in Florida during the winter. We played at a few RV parks, and so that's kind of how we got started with it.
Cool. You'll play, I guess, 90-something percent of the time during the show, harmonica. That's kind of your quote-unquote instrument.
That's 100% of the time.
On that show. But, you know, when I thought of you before starting to do some more research, I went, okay, you're the harmonica guy. You're the fellow on, obviously, Five Believers on the Dylan album. You're, that's what people think of you as. But you play how many instruments?
Well, I play a few keyboard, bass, guitar, vibraphone, a little trumpet, little saxophone.
You say that with such modesty. It's like a little trumpet. Well, I guess I have to jump to the Dylan stuff already, because you were the trumpet player on Rainy Day Women, numbers 12 and 35, the song that kicked off Blonde on Blonde. I mean, was it just the kind of thing that you were in the studio with Dylan, and you did harmonica, of course, but you played bass mostly on that record and some of his other things, right?
Well, the producer asked for a Salvation Army sound, and he said, we need a couple of horns, a trumpet, and a trombone. And I said, well, do you need the trumpet to be good? And he said, no, it needs to sound Salvation Army. And I said, okay, I'm your guy. And I called in a buddy of mine, a trombone player, but I wouldn't classify myself as a legitimate trumpet player like a Herb Alpert or anything like that.
Apart from the fact that you were more amateur trumpet player, Bob Johnston, the producer on Blonde on Blonde, and I guess it was Dylan's idea too, wanted all the musicians kind of drunk for that song. And that is a true story?
They wanted the attitude. That's not a true story.
Oh, no!
No. We don't really do that here. We don't, you know, it's kind of not permitted. But we pretended real good.
Wait, I thought they wanted to get you all high, and you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't go for the marijuana stuff. But
that's the way it works.
Yeah, no, but I thought they brought in beers and weird kind of drinky things and got you all loopy and loose. So it was all faking?
Yes.
Oh, man! I guess that's kind of neat in a way, because it sure fooled me. It sounds like a party.
Yeah, well, they said to us, they said, I want you guys to whoop it up, you know.
And you guys did.
So we did. We whooped it up.
Wow. Now, the rest of the record was more serious and not in that kind of atmosphere, but in the recording studio, gosh, and hopefully this isn't a myth too, that Dylan would just go into a room for hours.
The first day in particular, he hadn't finished writing Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. We were called in at 2 p.m. His flight was late. He showed up at 6, and we started recording at 4 a.m. the next morning.
Wow. Now, when you're all together, you can't work on other music or just jam for yourselves, because that'll annoy Dylan, who's trying to have a quiet. So you just play cards, or, you know?
Yeah, played cards, we played ping pong, we, you know, told stories. It's tough to kill that much time, you know, knowing any minute, okay, we even wanted to lay down and take a nap, but you're thinking, no, any minute he's going to be ready to go here, so we got to be ready. It's tough to record like that.
But you said that was really particularly bad just that first day for Sad Eyed Lady. Some of the other things, he was a little better?
Well, the other things, they were already ready, and he just went right into them, you know, and we joined in.
The other thing that I totally did not realize was that this wasn't your first experience working with him or meeting him, because Bob Johnston brought you in back when he was still doing Highway 61. And that
I was in New York, and I went over to Bob, promised me Broadway tickets. And I went over to the studio, and he said, hey, this is Bob Dylan. And Dylan said, hey, I'm going to do a song. Why don't you grab that guitar and play along? So that was Desolation Row.
And you are that sort of flamenco-ish guitar on that.
Yeah, I was doing my best Grady Martin imitation, and after I finished, I said, man, I hope Grady doesn't hear this.
Because compared to him, in your mind, you know, oh, God, I'm just flubbing it like on the trumpet, you know, whereas...
Yeah, well, I you know, I've had a lot of people tell me, oh, that Desolation Row is amazing guitar, and I'm thinking, no, it's not. I know better than that.
Oh, my God.
El Paso is amazing guitar. Hey, everybody, this is Charlie McCoy from Nashville. You're listening to Dave Lefkowitz on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
How does it feel, because in Nashville, you give the impression that a lot of musicians all work together and back into the 50s and 60s, everybody knew each other. You were always working with the same people, and it was kind of down home. There was no sense of necessarily awe, just respect. Was it different? Did you already know that when you walked into a Dylan session or Simon and Garfunkel or people like that? Was it different?
No, it wasn't different. I mean, when they recorded in Nashville, it wasn't different because we knew everybody except the artists, you know. But
right.
It happens a lot here. A new artist come to town all the time. But all the musicians knew each other, so that was not a problem.
But do you get starstruck ever? I mean, if you were working with Presley and, Orbison was almost more like, I wouldn't say family, but you probably knew him well enough that it was more like a friend, perhaps.
I must tell you, the first session with Orbison was pretty amazing. You know, I was 20 years old. It was only my second session, and I was pretty much in awe of the whole thing, you know.
So
it was my dream to do it, and here I was getting my chance, and not only getting my chance, but getting my chance with a big star.
What was it like working with him? I assume he was just very shy and nice guy?
He was amazing. Very soft-spoken, very quiet, but man, when he did that song, it spoke to you. Yeah, I had the privilege of playing on that session. We did Candyman and Blue Bayou. And then I had one more session with him. It was Pretty Woman.
Same instrument on all those songs?
Well, no, I didn't play harmonica. There's no harmonica. Oh. I played baritone saxophone.
Baritone? Wow.
Hey, everybody, this is Charlie McCoy from Nashville.
Also, among the people that you have met and that you have spoken highly of are Elvis Presley.
Yeah, what a gentleman he was. We were called in. He had the normal band that he always recorded with. And the movie company messed their schedule up for soundtrack, and they decided to come in early, and all the musicians he normally used were already working. So they hired an alternative group, so we all knew that he'd worked with that other group from the beginning, and so we were kind of like, boy, we hope that this is going to be okay, you know. And
yeah,
right, he hit the door, he went to every musician, shook their hand, and said, thank you for helping me.
Nice. Well, he was a well-bred, decent boy. I mean, up until drugs kind of destroyed him, and he was probably still a nice guy then, just
well,
in his own
you know,
fog.
The studio was his safe place. It was a comfort zone, and he was in there with people he respected. And so he was completely at ease. That was cool because then the creativity came out.
And you did say in another interview that he had this charisma about him that you've never really seen in anybody else.
I've never, you know, I was taken back by it because I wasn't prepared for it. The guy, he's just, he walks in a room and he commands attention. Johnny Cash was like that.
How did you meet Johnny Cash?
Oh, I got called to play on a record.
By Bob Johnston again? Because Cash was on stage.
No. Way back before Bob Johnston got involved with him.
Oh, okay.
He was recording with Frank Jones and Don Law way before Johnston ever came to town. So I was asked to play, he did actually a Dylan song. He did It Ain't Me, Babe. They called me in for that. That was early in the 60s.
So this was before you had actually met Dylan and played on Highway 61? Cool.
Yep.
Did your path cross with Cash often, or just...
I recorded with him many times. I did Orange Muscle Special with him. I did a song called Any Old Wind That Blows. Yeah, I recorded with him a lot.
Basically, it's just going through these names of folks that you have had sessions with or played on. I mean, Fats Domino. When did you play with Fats Domino?
He came into town in the early 80s and did a record. He did a album called The Fat Man, and he was involved with the same producer that was working with Elvis in the end of his career, Felton Jarvis.
Mm-hmm. But any memories of working on that session or of Fats Domino?
Well, we loved it because most of us were teenagers when he was in his heyday.
Mm.
It was really cool, and he was such a nice guy, and he just really enjoyed being here, and It was a nice experience.
So he came
happy,
to Nashville.
We were happy. Everybody was happy.
Well, are there sessions that you've had that were not so happy with folks? If they're alive, maybe you don't want to say because you might end up working with them again. but any stories out of school of things that were not so great behavior?
Well, I think the big problem is that sometimes in the 70s and 80s, after Ray Charles made his country album, a lot of people wanted to make, they thought it, you know, it was the end thing to make a country album with a pop artist, and there were several artists that came in, and their companies wanted them to do this, and I think deep down inside they didn't respect the music. And it was, you know, some of those things were not that great of an experience.
Can you name any names?
Not really.
Okay. If they've left this world, you know, you can kind of say, whereas you never know who you'll be working with again. I think that's the mantra of a session musician.
You know, it's not important who it was. For the most part, so many, the percentage of sessions that are really great here are, it's so high, you know, that it's like it's not even hardly worth mentioning.
Great. I'm curious about the session that you did. You were on Simon and Garfunkel's The Boxer.
It was a great session. I must say, Paul Simon is a genius. He dictated every note that he wanted me to play.
Oh, really? Okay.
He was exactly right. The guy's a genius.
Yeah.
Just think about how many different styles of hit records he's made in his career. That's really something special. And then even after they split up, he still continued to make hit records. Yeah, the guy was a genius. Like I say, he dictated every note for me, and he was right. He had heard it in his head what he wanted. You know, sometimes people can hear things, they don't know how to communicate it, but he communicated it perfectly. You know, there was no doubt about what he wanted.
Was Garfunkel there when you were working too, or had he done his thing?
No, he was there.
He was there. Were they getting along okay at that point? Were they even talking?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Oh, good.
Well, fine then. The next time I worked with Simon was after the breakup, and played on his first solo record.
One of the people that you mentioned that people haven't heard of, but you had an interesting story about someone named Owen Bradley.
Owen Bradley is the architect of the Nashville sound. He was the producer at the time. It was Decca Records.
Oh, well, yeah.
When I came to town, he was probably producing between 20 and 25 artists. They were all in the charts. Think about this.
Mm-hmm.
Three Christmas standards were all produced by Owen Bradley. Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree.
Uh-huh.
Bell Rock. Holly Jolly Christmas. They were all Christmas standards. And I would be willing to bet any amount of money that on each one of those sessions, they probably did two or three other songs as well.
The story that you told about him was that he worked with someone named Wilma Burgess. She only had one hit.
Yeah, he told me that was his favorite record he ever produced.
But what's your thing about that particular song? Because you were there for the session, I guess, and...
Well, he came up with a really cool arrangement with her vocal and then two answers with me and a steel guitar. And the way it all came together was really neat. Plus, the woman was an amazing singer.
Oh, I think you mentioned that he somehow took apart the song, because it was an ass, so I wasn't going anywhere, and he put it back together and turned it into...
He was famous for that. He was quite the musician, and he was famous for taking a song that was going nowhere and figuring out a way to switch it around so it was more interesting.
I would love to know specifically, you were there, so how did he... change that? So did he switch the chorus around? Was it about the arrangements? What did he physically do to make the song good?
Well, it was an arrangement. We had a demo that we listened to, which was nothing like what we ended up doing. And it was his old, like right on the spot. He had a flash, you know. And he said, "Look, let's do this." And he started saying what he wanted us to do, and right on, you know, right on, brilliant. But he used to do that all the time.
Cool. We are talking with Charlie McCoy, the legendary Charlie McCoy. I tried to keep my intro relatively short. It didn't work. I don't think I even mentioned that you were the musical director as well as appearing on Hee Haw for a bunch of years.
Yeah, I did that for a few years, and that was a great experience because, you know, you'd go to work every day and you're surrounded by legends. I mean, there were Minnie Pearl, Roy Acuff, Roy Clark, Buck Owens, Grandpa Jones.
Right.
It was amazing. That show was, it was one of the most efficient television shows that ever came down the road, because we would do 13 shows in a month.
Oh, my God.
Yep. We'd record in June and do the shows that would air from September to Christmas. We'd come back in October and do the shows that would air from Christmas till April, and then they'd rerun the whole set. And they had the very clever system they used, which they borrowed, by the way, from Rowan and Martin Sclafin.
Right.
The style of recording. You know, they would set up a set, like the post office, and do all 13 post office skits back to back. So you got the lighting set, you got the scene set, bang, 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 and then the whole show was put together in editing afterwards.
Do you have any particular memories, fond or otherwise, of funny things that happened on Hee Haw? Not necessarily on camera, but...
Well, if somebody would ever, if they would ever market the outtakes, they have enough, listen, they have more stuff on outtakes that's funnier than what was on the show.
Well, do you have any outtake memories of something that, that made you fall over laughing while you were there?
Well, we had a stagehand that used to go around, sneak up around behind the cornfield with a big fire extinguisher.
Yeah.
One of those kind that made a lot of racket, you know, and this guy would, he would sneak up behind people, and when they would finish their skit, he would shoot them. And they would, some people just jump out of their skin, you know. But we had stuff like that happen all the time.
And well, it keeps things lively. I mean, you're on such a tight schedule, you have to have that sense of release and fun, I think. Some of the other folks that you've worked with and I would love to hear about. George Jones.
Well, I played with George when he was on several other labels, but of course He Stopped Loving Her Today was, many people consider, maybe the greatest country record ever recorded. And I was really proud to be on that. And the producer, Billy Sherrill, who was also a genius, he sat at the piano, they ran the song down. He said, okay, let's hear this on mic. Well, he had forgotten that he'd hired me.
Oh.
And as he started for the control room, he looked and he saw me and he said, oh, get something on the second verse. That was it. Yeah, so it was a pretty amazing record.
In an average session that you do for folks, I mean, how many takes does it take to get the song the way it is? I mean, now I guess they do everything in bits and pieces. So you do one little piece here and one verse there.
They don't. Yeah. We still do it the old way here.
Really? Really? So you try and get it, you know, from beginning to end, and then you do little
bits. Musicians have the capability of going in and fixing an individual part. But back then, you know, it was, everybody was together. What you hear is what you get. Nobody wanted to be the guy that made everyone else have to do it again. So we were paying pretty close attention. And those records, you listen to them today, and they still sound amazing. All the Patsy Cline, the Brenda Lee, the Conway Twitty, the Tammy Wynette, and that's the way they were made. Everybody together, let's go do it.
Do you have memories of Patsy Cline?
I never got to work with Patsy.
Oh, okay. She
passed away, you know. I was just getting my start as a studio player when she was in the plane crash.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, she was listed somewhere as one of the people that you did.
I played on a record after the fact.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's one that kind of flummoxes me. Leonard Cohen's Songs from a Room is mentioned in some places and not in others. Were you there but uncredited?
No, I was there.
So you were on Songs from a Room. Do you remember which songs, and were you playing bass or what?
Playing bass, and no, I don't remember which songs.
Any memories of working with Leonard Cohen back then?
No, he just, he kind of stared off into space.
Yeah.
And sang, you know, he wasn't really that sociable.
Okay, well, yeah, he was in that poet mode back then. I would imagine, though, conversely, you have played with Ringo Starr.
I have. He did an album here called Boku of Blues.
Yeah.
In 77, and it was fun, and he really enjoyed it. He loved being with Nashville musicians, and I remember there was a news reporter there, and they said, well, can you tell us who your favorite country singer is? And he said, Kitty Wells.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Do you have any more memories of him, your interaction with him, or?
Not really.
Okay. So a lot of the time, you go into the studio, you work, you shake a hand, and it really doesn't go much beyond that.
No, because, you know, I know a lot of people have this idea about studio work. It's like a big, everyone's hanging out and visiting and all that. But, you know, we do a lot of work here. We're very efficient. The style of recording here was started by the old Nashville A-team, the Grady Martins of the world, the Floyd Kramers of the world. And we go in there with a purpose, and we go and get it done. And, you know, you're doing 3 and 4 songs every 3 hours. You don't have a lot of time for casual visiting, you know what I mean?
No, that's cool. And by the way, it's not just, and I don't want to make it sound like you played with this person, and that's why you were famous and important and stuff. You put out lots of albums of your own on Monument Records.
38 now.
38 albums. The most recent was only, what, 2 years ago? In 2011 you had one?
Well, I just had one released about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, congratulations. What's the name?
It's called Smooth Sailing.
Smooth Sailing, and people can get that, by the way, at
CharlieMcCoy.com, or they can get it at the concert in Greeley.
Where you will you sign the things afterwards? Will you stay at the table and...
Absolutely.
Oh, wonderful. Now, one of the...
out there to meet people.
And, yeah, let's also remind people that you are there tomorrow afternoon, Sunday, 2 o'clock, at the UCCC. Prices are really, really reasonable, which is great. You're getting three legends, actually, in concert. What's kind of cool about your website is that it feels... I mean, I'm sure you have helpers and people and stuff like that, but it feels also very like yours. It isn't just sent to some office in Toronto that does it for you. You feel connected to it, and that if people order your CDs and even cassettes and record albums, you deal with it.
I personally deal with it, and we'll sign every one of them if they want us to. We're very quick, too. I mean, we get an order, and we usually, no later than the next day, it's back in the mail.
This idea of wanting to be hands-on, wanting to be direct with the fans, wanting to do it yourself, is that just ingrained?
When I go out shopping, that's the way I want to be treated, you know. So we're trying to do the way we would like to be handled, you know. People appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course they will. I mean, who wouldn't want a signed copy of an album? To know that, oh my gosh, the mailing address is real, and it's possibly your handwriting on the label on the envelope.
Yep.
Are people still ordering record albums or LPs, or is it mostly CDs?
Not much. We keep thinking there's going to be a rebirth, but and some of the artists are now making LPs. I just got during CMA week, we always get a lot of, if you're a member of CMA, you get... People are trying to get you to vote for them, you know.
Yeah.
Let's see. I've got an LP here from Casey Musgraves. I got one here from Little Big Town, and I have one from Taylor Swift.
Okay.
And every you know, all the CMA members, and their LPs, and it's cool.
Well, what are your standards of judging when you're listening to new music or new country music? What do you look for?
Well, I'm looking for great songs, you know, and. Unfortunately, I think we had better songs to work with a few years ago.
Hmm. Well, have you had to adapt? I mean, as a session person, have you ever had to do any, I don't know, rap, hip-hop, accompany any of that?
No, we don't.
Modern stuff?
We don't have much of that around here.
Well, you don't only stay in Nashville, or do you generally just record in Nashville and you go elsewhere to tour?
Just in Nashville.
Cool.
Record, yeah. Hey, everybody, this is Charlie McCoy from Nashville. You're listening to Dave Lefkowitz on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Do you have any amazing, fun stories of touring, of your years in travel? Funny, wild things that have happened, amazing places you've been to?
Well, I've been, I just finished a tour in the Czech Republic in August.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. 7 dates in Czech and 1 in Slovakia. And I played a concert over there. It was nighttime, 50 degrees and raining. There were 1,000 people in the audience outdoors, and they never budged.
Wow. Do you ever, I guess you've had to deal with the elements, though, since we started the conversation with the elements. Do you ever feel fear if you're playing in the rain? You know, that something's not grounded properly?
Two extremes. I played in outdoors in Denmark. It was below freezing once.
Ooh.
And I played outdoors in the south of France, and it was like 104 degrees.
But, yeah. You know, you're a trooper. It would not be in your DNA to say, no, I'm not going to do this. Or can we wait 2 hours for some shade or for the sun to go down a little bit? You just go out there and get her done?
No, it's what we signed up for, so we go do it.
We're going to get back to Bob Dylan specifically because they just released that another self-portrait collection, this bootleg collection, which has you, I assume, all over it in those Nashville sessions. The difference between Dylan, when you met him for Highway 61 and Blonde on Blonde, and then getting back to him for Nashville Skyline and John Wesley Harding, into the self-portrait sessions, you said he was a completely different person.
I didn't think so.
Oh, well, I thought you said he was in a very different space and a totally different kind of a guy.
The music was different.
Oh.
He seemed to be a little more, he seemed to be a little more lost in the music, maybe more so. And you got to keep in mind, Blonde on Blonde was a weird experience for him because I don't know that he, in his mind, he was really that high on coming to Nashville to begin with. Bob Johnson really insisted, you know. But he came back, when he came back for John Wesley Harding, I think he was more comfortable. So that's what the difference I saw.
Oh, okay. I assumed from reading other interviews and stuff that he just seemed like a nicer guy, more connected, more happy, especially Nashville Skyline with songs about domesticity and things like that. What were your thoughts about Self-Portrait when it first came out?
I wasn't much into it. I think the producer wanted us to take a bunch of some of the music was like guitar vocal, almost like demos, and we were to add the instruments to make it into a record, you know. And to me, it wasn't as genuine as the other ones.
And I think people are finding that out now with this release of what were more like the demos, which are much more stripped down, and people are going, oh, wow, these were would have been a pretty cool album, but they sweetened it up a little bit too much.
Well, you know, that's not our choice. We do what they tell us to.
Well, but who was telling you, it was Bob Johnston telling you to do it? What, wouldn't have been Dylan, or was it?
No, Johnston.
Dylan had to approve it ultimately, but Johnston figured, well, let's take it in that direction. Now, moving totally back into a full country direction, I forgot to even ask you about working with Dolly Parton.
Yeah, I played on her first record. She came to Monument Records, and Boss Man there had me be session leader, and we did an album called Dumb Blonde. And then later, I got to record with her again after she went to RCA. We played on a record called My Tennessee Mountain Home. But, you know, I didn't work with her much.
And what about Loretta Lynn?
Loretta, I worked with Loretta a lot.
Ah.
With Burrow and Bradley.
Was it a thing of, did you know her at all personally? Or, again, were you just there, you did the thing, and...
I knew her in the studio, and she was very friendly and really down home, and... It was great working with her.
Cool. It's not like I'm looking for dirt. I'm just looking for stories or anecdotes or when people are really nice and just little bits about legends that we might not realize or that
most,
only you would know.
Most of the legends I know are really nice people.
Are there people that you never had the chance to work with that you wish you could?
Yes, Alan Jackson and Martina McBride.
Could happen. They're in Nashville. Do you think it might?
Perhaps, might. Oh, and Alison Krauss.
Okay.
Yeah, it could happen. It could. And, I hope it will sometime because I really respect what they do and think of the new, they're not the new people now, but of the later wave of country stars, they're the ones to me that I think are the best.
Cool. And can I ask, you're a session person, you're paid for the gig, and then you do it, and you go away. But do you ever feel disappointed or I guess that would be the word. Like when you work with somebody and it goes great and it's a great session and the record sounds really good, but then you're not called back again.
That happens here. That'll happen sometimes, you know.
Do you take it personally or not?
Right. After you've been on a huge record and then they call somebody else, it feels a little weird. But you know what? When one door closes, another one opens.
That's a wonderful attitude. And I sure hope people will be opening the doors to the UCCC, the Union Colony Civic Center, tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock to see Richard Kaiser and also Jason Coleman, who is Floyd Kramer's grandson, and by all means, the one and only Charlie McCoy. He will be there. He'll be selling his CDs after the show and autographing them too and shaking hands. And check out charliemccoy.com to order all sorts of stuff and find out all about his music. And I guess the last question for you would be, where do you see yourself? Now you're in your 70s. Do you see yourself slowing down, retiring ever, just doing what you do?
As long as I can make the man in the mirror proud of what I do, then I will continue to do it.
Charlie McCoy, a pleasure and an honor to be talking with you in the neighborhood. Have a wonderful gig in Greeley, terrific studio sessions wherever you are back in Nashville, and terrific touring everywhere as well. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, and I'm looking forward to saying hi to everybody in Greeley.